Part 2. The Laws of Combat. Chapter 5. Cover and Move. Leif Babin. South Central Ramadi, Iraq. Covering the flank. "So what are we doing?" asked our leading petty officer. The clock was ticking, and every second counted. There were no good options. Each one could have deadly consequences. But I had to make a call. As SEALs, we often protected the troops in the streets with our snipers and machine gunners in a type of operation we called Sniper Overwatch. By taking the high ground in buildings and positioning SEAL snipers where they could best observe and engage enemy fighters maneuvering to attack, we could eliminate threats and disrupt insurgent attacks before they could fully materialize. This helped mitigate the substantial risk to U.S. and Iraqi troops patrolling the streets, enabling them to more safely accomplish their mission and assured more U.S. soldiers and Marines came home alive to their families back in the States. The U.S. Army's Ready 1st Brigade Combat Team, 1st Armored Division, adopted a radical and innovative strategy to take back Ramadi from the malevolent clutches of the insurgency. Seize, clear, hold, build. It called for U.S. forces to penetrate into the most dangerous enemy-held neighborhoods, push back insurgent fighters, and construct permanent U.S. combat outposts from which to base further operations. Iraqi soldiers were brought in to take part in the effort. Once a foothold was established in enemy territory, the next step required a show of force in enemy-controlled areas with the Iraqi populace in the neighborhood. Though the battles raged around them, hundreds of thousands of civilians lived in the city and simply tried to survive. Securing the people and protecting them from the brutal jihadi fighters that hid among them was the key to victory. Integral to the success of this strategy were cordon and search operations, clearing through city blocks house by house. Often executed during daylight hours, these operations could be treacherous for the U.S. Army soldiers, Marines, and Iraqi troops as they cordoned off neighborhoods or sectors and moved street to street, building to building, through some of the most violent areas of the city. On one particular operation, Team Bulldog, U.S. Army Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 37th Armored Regiment, planned a large cordon and search operation in a particularly dangerous area of South Central Ramadi, spanning several blocks from their base located in the heart of enemy territory. A combat outpost called Cop Falcon. Such an operation required some 100 soldiers on the ground, supported by armor, M1A2 Abrams main battle tanks and M2 Bradley fighting vehicles, with their substantial firepower. Additional forces from the battalion were brought in to reinforce Team Bulldog in this effort. Through dozens of dangerous combat operations, we built an excellent working relationship with the U.S. soldiers and tankers of Team Bulldog. Bulldog's company commander was one of the finest combat leaders I've known. He and his soldiers were exceptional warriors. Our SEALs had tremendous respect and admiration for their courage and fighting spirit as they lived every day under constant attack, right in the heart of dangerous enemy territory. Our SEAL elements worked out of Cop Falcon and from there pushed even deeper into enemy territory. When we were ferociously attacked by insurgents, which was often, the company commander personally mounted up in his tank, rallied his troops, and brought the thunder with the main guns of Team Bulldog's M1A2 Abrams tanks to bear on our behalf. He and his Bulldog soldiers were an outstanding group, eager to close with and destroy the enemy, and we loved them for it. On this particular cordon and search operation, our SEALs from Charlie Platoon and Task Unit Bruiser would provide sniper overwatch while our SEAL combat advisors would manage a platoon of Iraqi soldiers participating in the clearance on the ground. Jocko teamed up with the Army Battalion's operations officer, who would help manage the clearance while Jocko would provide command and control as well as coordination of our SEAL elements supporting the operation. In planning, we decided to set up two separate SEAL sniper overwatch positions, several hundred meters apart, to cover the U.S. Army and Iraqi Army cordon and search teams as they entered buildings, block by block, across the sector. The first SEAL sniper overwatch position, OP1, led by Charlie Platoon's assistant officer in charge, would take position in a large, four-story apartment building, some 300 meters to the east of Cop Falcon, to protect the northern flank of the cordon and search teams. I would lead a second sniper overwatch position, OP2, of 8 SEALs and 7 Iraqi soldiers. We planned to take position about 1 kilometer southeast of Cap Falcon, along the southern flank of the coordinate search teams. The area was heavily IED'd. At 0200 local time, or 2 o'clock in the morning, those of us in OP2 stepped off via foot patrol from Cap Falcon into the dark and dangerous Ramadi streets. Empty at this hour, all appeared quiet, but in this neighborhood, enemy fighters could be waiting around every corner. The other SEAL overwatch team, OP1, would depart an hour later, since their position was very near the friendly combat outpost, and it was one they knew well, having utilized this position before. My team, OP2, had much farther to travel, and not having been in any of the buildings in the immediate area, we would need more time to establish a good position. On the patrol end, I served as patrol leader, positioned second from the front, just behind the point man. We moved as quietly as possible through the streets, weapons trained at every angle, watching for enemy, ready for contact at all times. We took great care to avoid debris, such as trash piles on the street or other suspicious items, being deliberate in where we stepped as the threat from IEDs was substantial. Each man carried a heavy load of weapons, ammunition, and water in anticipation of what we knew could likely be a big and lengthy fight come daylight. This urban war zone was straight out of a Hollywood set for a World War II movie like the ones we watched growing up. Walls riddled with bullet holes, burnout cars in the street, rubble buildings, and bomb craters. It was surreal to be in a place filled with such violence and destruction. We continued our patrol down the dusty, trash-covered streets, weapons bristling in all directions. Our patrol snaked through alleyways, avoiding the rare operating street lamp. Most had been shot out or didn't have electrical power, and maneuvered the best we could around packs of mangy street dogs whose barking could give away our position. We planned to utilize a 2-story house as our OP2 overwatch position and thought it would provide a clear view to cover the coordinate search team's southern flank. After a 20-minute patrol without incident, we arrived at the location. Just outside the walled compound, the entire element took up security positions around the gate. With weapons covering, we boosted a couple of our Iraqi soldiers over the wall. They quickly unbolted the gate from the inside and then let the rest of us in. SEAL shooters and Iraqi soldiers swiftly but quietly flowed into the compound and moved toward the house's front door. Iraqi soldiers knocked and instructed the family inside to open up. A bewildered Iraqi man answered the door and complied. SEALs quickly cleared the compound, checking each room, a second-story balcony, the rooftop, and the interior courtyard for threats. Once clear, we set security positions. The house provided a decent view in one direction along the main road. In the other direction, however, it offered little vantage point except for an exposed balcony. It was also difficult to place key security positions without exposing personnel to attack from surrounding buildings. Our OP2 snipers brought these significant concerns to me and our platoon's leading petty officer, or LPO, one of my most trusted leaders. We were in a bind. We could take the building next door and maintain a security contingent there, the LPO offered. It was a great idea, and we decided to pursue that option. Leaving a team in place, we sent a clearance team to the adjacent building. But what they found was not encouraging. The vantage point was no better. Positioning adequate security forces in 2 different buildings would spread us extremely thin, especially in such a dangerous neighborhood crawling with heavily armed Mouj. With this option not practical, I talked things over with my LPO. It was still dark, but sunrise was not far off, and the first call to prayer would soon echo from the mosque minarets and awaken the city. Time was running out to get into position, especially as the coordinate search teams of Army soldiers, our SEAL advisor teams, and Iraqi soldiers would commence their operations soon and were depending on our sniper overwatch team to cover them. No options are good, I lamented, but our least bad option is to pull everyone back to our original building and secure that position as best we can. The LPO agreed and immediately executed the plan. We knew the position had substantial vulnerabilities, but we would have to do all we could to mitigate such risks. Our SEAL snipers took positions to best protect the troops on the ground, and then we placed the rest of our team in positions to protect the snipers, one of whom was somewhat exposed on the balcony. With a position set, OP2's SEAL radioman made a call to our other SEAL sniper overwatch, OP1, reporting our position. We then checked in on Team Bulldog's net and passed our location to Jocko, who was with Team Bulldog at Cop Falcon, so he could coordinate with the other troops on the ground. Echoed the first call to prayer from the minaret loudspeakers of mosques throughout the city, signaling the dawning of the day. Soon, the first rays of light painted the eastern horizon, and South Central Ramadi began to awaken. Even in this war-torn city, some semblance of normal life carried on. People emerged from their houses, cars and trucks backed out of driveways and made their way down city streets. Shepherd boys drove their herds of sheep down the road to graze along the fertile banks of the Euphrates River. The sun rose with searing heat, which would crescendo midday to baking temperatures of over 115 degrees Fahrenheit. Over the radio, the soldiers of Team Bulldog signaled their coordinate search operation was underway. Dozens of soldiers, including the SEAL advisor and Iraqi soldier clearance team, moved out from Cop Falcon, accompanied by armored firepower from Abrams tanks and Bradley vehicles. From our position, hundreds of meters away, OP-2 could hear the heavy grind of tank tracks on pavement and the rev of their powerful gas turbine engines. I checked in with Jocko via radio as he moved out with a coordinate search team. All was proceeding according to plan. In such a nasty neighborhood, it didn't take long for enemy fighters to mount an attack. The first attempts came from the north. OP-2 could hear the report of big rifles as OP-1's SEAL snipers hammered a couple of armed insurgents moving to attack. Soon, our OP-2 snipers observed three enemy fighters with AK-47s and an RPG rocket maneuvering through the streets toward the clearance teams. SEAL snipers engaged, hitting two of the three and sending the third running for cover. With those shots, the enemy had a good indication of where we were. Within the hour, the first burst of Muj machine gun fire snapped over the heads of the two SEALs positioned on the balcony. It was only the beginning, as the enemy sporadically engaged our building and probed our position. We knew their attacks would no doubt grow bolder as they pinpointed our position and the day progressed. The coordinate search operation proceeded with sporadic gunfire and a few warning shots fired. The SEAL sniper overwatch positions were able to help thwart any major attacks before they could materialize. The vigilant Team Bulldog soldiers, with their tanks at the ready, were also a substantial deterrent. Within about 2 hours of sunrise, the Army soldiers, along with Jocko and the small team of SEAL combat advisors with their Iraqi soldiers, had cleared every building in the sector. Having accomplished their mission, they all moved safely back to Cop Falcon. It had been a relatively smooth operation, which, in such a dangerous neighborhood, right in the heart of South Central Ramadi, was somewhat miraculous. No American or Iraqi soldiers had been wounded or killed. That was a testament to the good planning and execution by the U.S. forces involved, and a tribute to the effectiveness of the SEAL sniper overwatch teams. With the coordinate search force back at Cop Falcon, both SEAL overwatch teams, OP-1 and OP-2, had accomplished our objectives. Our standard operating procedure, or SOP, dictated we remain in position until nightfall and then patrol back to base under cover of darkness when we could more safely move through the dangerous streets. A small element patrolling in broad daylight through enemy territory presented serious risk of almost certain contact. Enemy machine guns, RPG-7, shoulder-fired rockets, and IEDs could be utilized to deadly effect. But for OP-2, remaining in our current position also presented great risk. The building we held had substantial tactical vulnerabilities. The enemy knew where we were, and there was a high probability that with enough time, enemy fighters would mount a serious attack. Should they do so, we might very well take significant casualties and even find our position overrun by determined enemy fighters at close quarters. This presented quite a leadership dilemma. Again, I discussed options with my trusted LPO. We can stay where we are and wait until nightfall, or we can quickly break out of here and foot patrol back to Cop Falcon. Or we could call in the Bradleys for extract, though that could take some time. Bradley fighting vehicles provided protection from small arms fire behind their armor plating, and they brought significant firepower with a 25mm chain gun and 7.62mm coaxial machine gun. But they required some time to coordinate, to brief crews and drive to our position. Bradleys were loud, and the bad guys would hear them coming from some distance. This option would also expose the U.S. soldiers that crewed the vehicles to the substantial IED threat, as the roads in the vicinity of our position were extremely dangerous and had not been swept by the IED clearance teams. This could very well result in an IED strike, a deadly explosive buried in the road which might kill or seriously wound the soldiers inside. Were this to happen, it would require sending even more vehicles and troops in harm's way to extract casualties and downed vehicles. Calling in the Bradleys meant waiting for perhaps another half hour and would put Team Bulldog soldiers in significant danger. It would also endanger us riding in the vehicles through heavily IED'd streets. If we stayed in position until dark in accordance with SOP, we would almost certainly have to fend off increasingly violent enemy attacks for another 8 to 10 hours. Should those attacks exploit the significant weaknesses of our defenses, we might be pinned down and unable to depart without calling in massive fire support and putting more forces at even greater risk to bail us out. If we pulled out on foot immediately and quickly patrolled back to Cap Falcon, we would probably get shot at, but it would likely be a hasty attack that the Mouge wouldn't have enough time to coordinate for maximum effectiveness. We could help mitigate that risk by moving quickly and utilizing misdirection in the streets and alleyways to prevent the enemy from predicting our exact route back to Cap Falcon so they couldn't set an ambush. Still, any gunfire we receive, no matter how hasty, could certainly kill or horribly wound any of us. No options were good options. We had to choose the least bad option. "So what are we doing, LT?" asked the LPO. Time was ticking. I had to make a call. "We're pulling out," I decided. It was the least bad option. "Let's get packed up quick and break out of here as soon as we can." "Roger that," said the LPO. He passed the word to the rest of OP2, and everybody quickly gathered up their gear and double-checked to ensure nothing was left behind. Our OP2 radioman contacted OP1, the other sniper overwatch team, to tell them we were moving back on foot to the combat outpost. We also notified Team Bulldog soldiers back at Cap Falcon, where Jocko and a few of our SEALs with the clearance team had returned. For OP1, only a short 300-meter patrol from Cap Falcon, there was no such dilemma about what to do. They had an easy foot patrol back to Cap Falcon, covered by Cap Falcon's nearby tanks and heavy machine guns the entire way. OP1 radioed to us and OP2 that they too were pulling out. But OP1 made the mistake of not telling Jocko, which meant he could not coordinate the movement. "Roger that," our OP2 radioman responded to OP1's call. He relayed the information to the LPO and me. With our focus entirely on getting OP2 moving out in a hurry, we thought little of it. Every minute that passed by gave enemy fighters more time to coordinate a serious attack on our position. Within a few minutes, everyone was ready. We quickly briefed the team and emphasized that we needed to move fast. "Let's do this," was the consensus. Everybody knew we would likely get in a gunfight, but we wanted that gunfight to be on our terms, not the enemy's. With everything ready, we broke out of the building and emerged onto the street, our weapons pointed in all directions, ready for a fight. We quickly moved out and made our way through the streets, covering and moving as a team past Iraqi citizens who stared at us with some surprise. When aggressive men with guns pointed their weapons at them, the locals knew to keep their distance. Anyone who didn't avoid interfering with a heavily armed SEAL squad was certainly looking for trouble. Rapidly, we pushed past parked cars and piles of trash. Threats were everywhere in this urban environment. Every gate, door, and alleyway that we passed, the distant intersections down the street at ground level, and above us from every rooftop, balcony, and upstairs window. Each presented the possibility of well-armed Mouge fighters ready to inflict horrible wounds or death upon us. Our tactic, which we had trained for, practiced, and utilized, was a fundamental one we called cover and move. Within our OP2 squad, we had four elements of smaller teams. One team covered, their weapons trained on threats, while the other team moved. Then those teams reverse roles. In this way, the teams leapfrogged in bounds, constantly utilizing cover and move to ensure we were prepared to fend off an attack as we maneuvered through the streets. For about 500 meters, OP2 moved along steadily, making our way back toward Cap Falcon. Then, all hell broke loose. Fully automatic gunfire erupted from the rear of our patrol. Insurgent fighters had followed us and heavily engaged us with AK-47s and PKC belt-fed machine guns, and round smash into nearby walls and kicked up dust in the street right at our feet. Immediately, we responded with withering gunfire of our own. Our SEAL machine gunners were an awesome sight to behold, fearlessly laying down fire with deadly accuracy even as enemy rounds impacted all around them. Like a well-oiled machine, we executed a center peel maneuver, a coordinated tactic where two columns systematically alternate shooting at the enemy and moving away in a safe direction until able to break contact. I lobbed a few 40mm grenades over the heads of our patrol and onto enemy positions to help keep their heads down as we bounded back. Our overwhelming fire quickly repulsed the enemy attack, and we continued to a street corner that provided additional cover, moving in a hurry toward Cop Falcon. Those courageous SEAL machine gunners had provided the cover fire that enabled us to move safely through the maelstrom. Within minutes, we covered the remaining distance to the cop and made our way past the Abrams tank guarding the entrance. We pushed past the concertina wire and concrete barriers into the relative safety of the U.S. Army Combat Outpost. We were breathing hard after running and gunning in the late morning heat with heavy gear, but we had all survived without a scratch. The LPO and I smiled and laughed at each other. We had just gotten ourselves into a solid gunfight on the street, hammered the enemy, and brought everyone back unscathed. It was awesome. We were fired up. But already back at Cop Falcon was our platoon chief. He had been with the cordon and search force and had returned earlier with Jocko and the rest of our small team of SEALs and the Iraqi soldiers. Chief wasn't happy. He pulled me aside. "What the hell were you guys doing out there?" the chief asked sternly. "What do you mean?" I asked, immediately getting defensive. The chief was a hell of a battlefield leader, extraordinary in a gunfight. With a long career of nearly 20 years, he was the most experienced SEAL in the task unit, and we highly valued his guidance and mentorship. Never one to shy away from a fight, he was courageous and always eager to close with and destroy the enemy. So why now was he critical of us, particularly my leadership on the battlefield? "What are you talking about?" I said. "Why didn't you leave the other sniper overwatch position, OP1, in place to cover your movement back here to Cop Falcon?" the chief asked. I thought about that for a moment. My initial defensiveness wore off. He was right. "No reason," I replied. Understanding his logic was absolutely correct. I realized my error. I was so focused on our own squad's dilemma, I didn't think to coordinate with the other team, OP1, to work together. We absolutely should have. This was the first rule in Jocko's Laws of Combat: cover and move. I had broken it. We had used cover and move within our own immediate OP2 team, but I had forgotten about the greater team and support available. We had operated independently, failing to support or help each other. Had we left OP1 in place, they would have had an excellent vantage from the high ground and could have covered our OP2 movement much of the way as we patrolled through the dangerous streets back to Cop Falcon. Once at the cop, we, OP2, could have provided additional cover for OP1 as they returned to Cop Falcon. It was foolishness not to work together. Though we were working in small teams with some distance between us, we weren't on our own. We were all trying to accomplish the same mission. The enemy was out there working against us, all of us. It was essential that we support each other and work together. One element must cover so that the other element could move. Our OP2 had gotten lucky this time around. Damn lucky. But my chief knew, and I now recognized, that we had taken a needless and foolish risk. We should have utilized every strength and tactical advantage possible against these ruthless enemy fighters occupying Ramadi. The most important tactical advantage we had was working together as a team, always supporting each other. It was a rude awakening for me. I had become so immersed in the details, decision points, and immediate challenges of my own team that I had forgotten about the other team, what they could do for us, and how we might help them. Going forward, I never forgot my chief's guidance. We utilized the principle of cover and move on every operation, all teams working together in support of one another. That realization and the lesson learned implemented no doubt saved lives, greatly reduced casualties, and enabled us to more effectively accomplish our mission and win. Principle: cover and move. It is the most fundamental tactic, perhaps the only tactic. Put simply, cover and move means teamwork. All elements within the greater team are crucial and must work together to accomplish the mission mutually supporting one another for that singular purpose. Departments and groups within the team must break down silos, depend on each other, and understand who depends on them. If they forsake this principle and operate independently or work against each other, the results can be catastrophic to the overall team's performance. Within any team, there are divisions that arise. Often, when smaller teams within the team get so focused on their immediate tasks, they forget about what others are doing or how they can depend on other teams. They may start to compete with one another, and when there are obstacles, animosity and blame develops. This creates friction that inhibits the overall team's performance. It falls on leaders to continually keep perspective on the strategic mission and remind the team that they are part of the greater team and the strategic mission is paramount. Each member of the team is critical to success, though the main effort and supporting efforts must be clearly identified. If the overall team fails, everyone fails, even if a specific member of an element within the team did their job successfully. Pointing fingers and placing blame on others contributes to further dissension between teams and individuals. These individuals and teams must instead find a way to work together, communicate with each other, and mutually support one another. The focus must always be on how best to accomplish the mission. Alternatively, when the team succeeds, everyone within and supporting that team succeeds. Every individual and every team within the larger team gets to share in the success. Accomplishing the strategic mission is the highest priority. Team members, departments, and supporting assets must always cover and move, help each other, work together, and support each other to win. This principle is integral for any team to achieve victory. Application to business. "Those guys are horrible," said the production manager. He described a subsidiary company owned by their parent corporation on which his team depended to transport their product. "They can't get their jobs completed on schedule, and that prevents us from doing our jobs." Clearly, there were major issues between his field leaders, the frontline troops of his team, and those of the subsidiary company. Jocko and I stood before the class of a dozen mid-level managers seated at tables forming a U-shape in a conference room of the company's corporate headquarters. In the second session of a 12-month leadership training program, our presentation and discussion centered on the laws of combat. We solicited from each of the class participants specific leadership challenges that they currently faced. Jocko and I set about to help them solve these challenges through the application of the SEAL combat leadership principles they had just learned. The production manager explained that his team struggled to minimize downtime in their production, the times when they had to cease making product. These disruptions occurred for a variety of reasons, but they stopped product from moving to market, and every hour and day of downtime cost the company huge revenues and substantially impacted the bottom line. With his crew just getting up and running, there had been a steep learning curve. The production manager's team maintained an average downtime that was much worse than the industry standard. Such a glaring discrepancy was a major detriment to the company's profits. As a result, the production manager was under scrutiny and intense pressure to reduce downtime. The subsidiary company on which his production team depended became the major scapegoat to blame. "We spend a lot of our time waiting on them," the subsidiary company, "and that causes big problems and delays for us," said the production manager. "Those delays are impacting production and costing our company serious revenue." "How can you help this subsidiary company?" I asked the production manager. "I can't," he replied. "They don't work for me. We don't work for the same bosses. They are a different company." While he was right that they were a different company, both companies fell under the leadership of the same parent corporation. "Besides," he added with indifference, "they aren't my problem. I've got my own team to worry about." "It sounds like they are your problem," I responded. "In that sense," he agreed, "I guess they are." "What's worse," continued the production manager, now on a roll of bashing the subsidiary company, "because corporate owns them, we're forced to use their services." "What you just called the worst part should be the best part," Jocko responded. "You're both owned by the same corporation, so you both have the same mission. And that is what this is about, the overall mission, the overall team. Not just your team, but the whole team, the entire corporation, all departments within your company all subsidiary companies under the corporation, outside contractors, the whole enterprise. You must work together and support each other as one team. The enemy is out there, I said, pointing out the window to the world beyond. The enemy is all the other competing companies in your industry that are vying for your customers. The enemy is not in here, inside the walls of this corporation. The departments within and the subsidiary companies that all fall under the same leadership structure. You are all on the same team. You have to overcome the us versus them mentality and work together, mutually supporting one another. Just as I had on the battlefield in Ramadi years before, the production manager was now so focused on his own department and its immediate tasks that he couldn't see how his mission aligned with the rest of the corporation and supporting assets, all striving to accomplish the same strategic mission. As I had done, after some constructive guidance from my chief, the production manager must now be willing to take a step back and see how his production team's mission fit into the overall plan. It's about the bigger strategic mission, I said. How can you help this subsidiary company do their job more effectively so they can help you accomplish your mission and you can all win? The production manager pondered this. He was still skeptical. Engage with them, directed Jocko. Build a personal relationship with them. Explain to them what you need from them and why, and ask them what you can do to help them get you what you need. Make them a part of your team, not an excuse for your team. Remember the stories Leif and I have told about relying on other units to support us? Those Army and Marine Corps units we worked with were not under our control. We had different bosses, but we depended on them and they depended on us. So we formed relationships with them and worked together to accomplish the overall mission of securing Ramadi. That's cover and move. You need to do the same thing here. Work together to win. The production manager was a driven leader who wanted his team to perform at the highest level. Now he began to understand true teamwork. The proverbial light bulb went off in his head, and his attitude completely changed. If he wasn't working together with his subsidiary company, then he was failing his team. Over the next weeks and months, the production manager made every effort to positively engage with the subsidiary company, to communicate with them, and establish a better working relationship. He came to more fully understand the myriad challenges that impacted their timelines and caused delays, and what he could do on his end to help mitigate those issues. It wasn't that they were horrible, as he had initially surmised. They were operating with limited resources and limited manpower. Once he accepted that they weren't out to sabotage his team, he realized that there were steps that he and his team could take to help the subsidiary company become more efficient and fill in the gaps that had caused their delays. Instead of working as two separate entities against each other, they began to work together. With this shift in mindset, the production manager's encouragement enabled his field leaders to see the subsidiary company employees in a different light. Not as adversaries, but as critical resources, part of the same greater team. Most important, the production team began to work with the subsidiary company's field team. Within a few months, the production team's field leaders encouraged key personnel from the subsidiary company to sit in on their coordination meetings. Very soon, the us versus them mentality had all but disappeared. They had broken through the silos and no longer worked against each other. The production team's downtime radically improved to industry-leading levels. They now work together as one team. Cover and move.